I'm Terrence McNally, sitting in for Warren Only, back with To the Point from PRI. The stock market is roaring and applications for unemployment are down, but there's disappointing news in Thursday's economic data. In January, manufacturing growth slowed, construction spending dipped, and Americans' after-tax income fell, leading to a fourth straight month of weak consumer spending. Why the continued gap between Wall Street and Main Street, and what can we do about it? On Reporter's Notebook, Russia votes Sunday, and despite the largest protests in decades, Putin is still confident of victory. First, this news update. Iranians went to the polls in parliamentary elections today, with many reformists and opposition leaders not participating. The vote is a contest between hardline supporters of President Ahmadinejad and Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Pressure from the West over Iran's nuclear program has been a central issue in the campaigns. Joining us now is Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Welcome to The Point.
Thank you. Pleasure to be there.
So first of all, with the elections, how have things gone at the polls? How is turnout? What do we know?
Well, the government has announced a turnout of 64.6%, but I have to say that nobody is believing this figure. People I've spoken to, reporters who are in Tehran, report that it's very, very light voting, particularly in upper middle class areas, particularly in Tehran. Reporters who've gone to Iran to try to report on this have not even been able to do so freely. They've essentially been bussed from one polling station to another and then sent back to their hotels. So I think it's fair to say that turnout was much lower than what the government has announced.
Okay. And this is the first poll since mass protests greeted Ahmadinejad's disputed presidential election in 2009, yet the Green Movement is not taking part. What's the situation there?
Well, most of the reformists have said they would not take part. There are a few reformist candidates still participating. But there's simply no good reason for Iranians to vote unless they absolutely have to in order to satisfy certain requirements, say, for their job. Some perhaps are concerned that if they don't get a stamp on their various internal documents, it might hurt them at some point. Some people are afraid of losing subsidies for food, that sort of thing. So you do have some people who are doing that. You have others who are loyal to the regime and want to show that they can't be intimidated by Western threats of a military option. But by and large, I think Iranians are very disaffected. I was there 4 years ago during the last parliamentary elections, and the turnout was anemic then. So you can imagine, after what people experienced in 2009, that they're simply not eager to go and vote for Tweedledee or Tweedledum.
Right. There's been a government crackdown in the last few weeks. What form has that taken?
A lot of people have been arrested. There have been disruptions of service with the internet. This kind of behavior we've seen really since 2009, heavy security presence in the cities to prevent any kind of demonstrations against the government. These are not the actions of a self-confident, popular government.
Okay. Now, this vote is a contest between supporters, as I said, of Ahmadinejad, the president, and Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Remind us again of their differences.
Well, their differences really aren't that great. That's why I say Tweedledum and Tweedledee. It might even be Tweedledee and Tweedledee. This is a fight over power. This is a fight over who will determine the next president in elections next year. The ideological differences between Khamenei and Ahmadinejad are not exactly great. In fact, Ahmadinejad now is styling himself as, you know, something of a reformer and something of a man who would like to negotiate with the West, which is laughable when you consider the types of policies that he imposed and the rhetoric that he used when he came in, when he came into power first in 2005. So I think this is really a fight within a diminishing political elite over the diminishing spoils of power.
Mm-hmm. With about 90 seconds, Barbara, next week President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meet and both address the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in D.C. And they have differing views of both the threat Iran presents, the action that ought to be taken, and they have differing audiences. What do we expect?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how much open disagreement we'll see. There's certainly been a lot of leaks in the run-up suggesting that they are not on the same page. And I see that Prime Minister Netanyahu has just said in Canada that talks with Iran are a waste of time. Well, the Obama administration is contemplating another round of negotiations. So already here we see a gap. The president told the Atlantic in an interview that once again, you know, all options on the table, an Iranian nuclear weapon is unacceptable. But he's also, I think, trying to persuade the Israelis that it would be precipitous to take military action now, that sanctions are working, that Iran is more isolated than it has ever been, and that the consequences of military action now would, frankly, be quite dire.
So we expect that just to, that both will do what they do, and we'll see where we go from here.
Yeah, you know, I think that there is some space between the United States and Israel, and Iran with nuclear weapons is not an existential threat to the United States. I don't think it is to Israel, frankly, but it's hard to persuade Benjamin Netanyahu of that.
Very good. Thank you for joining us, Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. I'm Terrence McNally, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Russia goes to the polls this weekend. Vladimir Putin, who's been suggesting Russia could walk away from the START II treaty and accusing Hillary Clinton of encouraging protests in his country, is heavily favored in Sunday's elections. Joining me now is Matthew Rozhansky, Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to The Point, Matthew.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Since everyone assumes that Putin is going to win this election, what's going on kind of behind and beneath that fact? What are the questions and stories that we ought to be paying attention to?
Well, I think there are several levels on which you can look at Sunday's events and what happens after Sunday. The first is obviously, does Putin win in the first round? Sunday is nominally a first round. There are five candidates, and so in theory, if none of the candidates wins an outright majority, then they would go on to a second round later in March. Now, it's expected that Putin will win a majority, but then the second question is it a convincing majority? And it could fail to be convincing on either of two levels. One is that it's just small numerically. 51%, for example, wouldn't be seen necessarily as a national mandate. But the second and more troubling one would be if there are allegations that are credible, maybe backed up by cell phone video or credible stories that get out into the press, that there's been wide-scale fraud. I think that's unlikely to happen given the flak that Putin took and that the United Russia Party took after December's fraud in the Duma, the parliamentary elections, but it's possible. And then the third level on which I would analyze this is, you know, what does Putin do once he is most probably elected, whether it's Sunday or later on in March, to kind of deal with this new breath, what some people have called a Slavic spring, of freedom, of citizenship that Russian people, at least in Moscow and St. Petersburg and other big cities, are bringing out onto the streets and kind of demanding much more say in how the country is run. He's got to deal with that.
And let's talk about I'll take those points in order. The first one in terms of whether I've read that polls even place him at 60%. Am I reading wrong polls, or is there really some question?
I think there really is some question. So, you know, I describe Russia as having essentially three groups of voters, and they're roughly one-third, one-third, one-third of the electorate. There's a third that is just inimically opposed to Putin. They can't stand him. They can't stand the system. They have different reasons, by the way. Some of them are ultra-nationalists. Some of them are ultra-liberals, but they mm-hmm. just can't stand Putin. Then you've got folks who really believe in Putin. They'd accept him no matter what because he's delivered stability and prosperity. And then you have this third in the middle that I call Russia's swing voters. And these are the people that really Putin has gone after in the last couple of months by saying, look, there's no credible opposition. You know, you've got communists running against me, you've got ultra-nationalists, and you've got liberals who are discredited because the 1990s were chaos. You know, that was the liberal time in Russia. And I think Putin has won over a lot of those people. But whether he's won over enough of them that he can put his third together with that entire third and get to a very convincing 60%, I think is still in doubt.
And I've heard the communists might be expected to finish second. What is their remaining appeal at this time?
It's not much, to be quite frank, Terrence. You know, speaking as a member of the post-Cold War generation, I find it almost inconceivable, as do my friends, that a communist could ever lead Russia again. You know, there's an older generation that remembers, you know, the Brezhnev era or even the early Gorbachev years as a time of stability where they at least knew they had a job. They knew they had an apartment. Some of them had other nice privileges. They didn't have the freedom to travel. They couldn't start businesses and so on until much later. But it was a time of predictability and thus relative happiness. And those people have suffered disproportionately in the 20 years since then. But this is very nostalgic. And by definition, these folks are older, so this is a shrinking constituency. So the communists will probably come in second. Zyuganov, the communist candidate who's been running literally for 20 years, you know, will probably command somewhere 15 or 20% of the vote. But that's about where they're capped.
Mm-hmm. And shrinking.
Exactly.
As they get older. The protests in December showed frustrations in the middle class. You mentioned, a possible spring. Today, in speaking with Western reporters, Putin said those demonstrations were good for Russia, and he admitted that he's less popular in Moscow and the big cities than he is rurally. I have two questions, really. What are they protesting about? What's the dissatisfaction? And do we have any reason to think that he might actually respond?
So this, let me just, if I can, answer the second question first. This is the genius of Vladimir Putin. Those who, to paraphrase Mark Twain, right, those who declare Putin to be dead and gone and brittle and falling apart have wildly underestimated this guy. I mean, he is so able to roll with the punches, to adapt to the situation. He's no great genius. From my colleagues who've spoken with him, they've said, but the guy is wily. He's foxy. He's an intelligence operative and has been trained that way. And so I think he sort of knows where to put pressure release valves in the system. And one of them is to acknowledge, look, you people have a legitimate right to protest. You know, he mocks them out of the side of his mouth at the same time. But he's trying to take a little steam out of this movement by saying, yes, absolutely, democracy is important. We're on the way to reform. You know, just be patient and we'll move in that direction. Propose your ideas. If 100,000 people or more will sign up to an initiative online, it will receive consideration. These are all ways of sort of throwing a bone to this movement. You couldn't even call it an opposition because it's not a unified political opposition to this movement so that it doesn't become an acute revolutionary opposition. Your question about, you know, why these folks are protesting, I guess, is begun to address that. I think they want citizenship in a more robust sense, in a sort of classical sense of the social contract. The people who are coming out onto the streets, some of them are just spectators. You know, they're done with their shopping, they're done with their work for the day. Why not come out and see this, you know, this carnival atmosphere, as some folks have called it? But I think the ones who are leading it, you know, it's not about politics. It's about participation in the system. They don't want to be pawns or props anymore in a play. They want to be real players on the stage themselves.
Okay, thank you very much for talking to us. We'll be watching what happens in Russia on Sunday. Matthew Rozhansky, Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.